The Guardian. Welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Jemima Kish. Coming up...
So, to say computer in Mandarin, Tiannao, is to effectively say electric brain.
Author Tom Chatfield explores the role of the internet in reshaping and accelerating the creation of new words and forms of language in his new book, Netymology.
It has its own look that's is really nice. It's quite industrial, but I really, really quite liked it just as a piece of hardware.
And never judge a laptop by its cover. Google's Chromebook with a difference. The high-end Chromebook Pixel is about to be released. I'll be joined by my colleague Michael Brunton-Spall to take a look under its bonnet and see if this slick rival to the Apple PowerBook really stands a chance. We'll have a look at this week's tech news, including the demise of the external hard drive and why the UK is resisting a legal right to be forgotten online. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The digital age has brought with it a lexicon of new words, and this linguistic explosion is the subject of Tom Chatfield's new book, Netymology. For Tech Weekly, Alex Kotowski spoke to Tom and started out by asking him if it's fair to see the birth of the internet as a boom time for new forms of language.
I think it's fair to say that we are. I mean, this is not something new for the English language. If you look back to the age of Shakespeare, the Renaissance, we had these sort of collisions between linguistic worlds and French and Italian, as well as Latin and Greek and even Arabic. It's above all because so many people are taking part, but also because the act of typing onto a keyboard or tapping your fingers on a touchscreen, this is becoming the driving force behind the evolution of language. And so we're seeing all these variations and registers and types of word aimed at the eye rather than at the ear. And, you know, sort of multiplying, you know, as like memes do, like things do online. We're seeing a kind of an acceleration in the processes by which words get codified and multiply and interbreed.
That's actually the interesting thing about the book that you wrote, is that you're not actually sort of making a list of here's definitions. You're actually taking a look at the origins of some of the words, or at the evolutions of existing concepts and how they've been reformed into contemporary society. Can you talk me through some of the characteristics of say words like avatar, or, you know, what you call the Cupertino effect, or you know, cyber, and all of these, how these words have meanings or have had meanings in the past but are now evolving into something that we're using in the now?
Yes, so there's an evolutionary process going on, as you're saying, and the thing I love about talking about language is you get to talk about the human stories behind words. And that means you have to talk about, you know, the history to things. And often when we deal with technology, it's like we're pretending that stuff just exists immaculately out there. It kind of happens to us. You mentioned the word avatar. I love the history behind this word, because it started out in Sanskrit and came to Hindi through Sanskrit. And avatara there, it meant descent or incarnation. So when a deity like Krishna was coming down to perform acts on the earth, he would incarnate himself and descend from the heavens into the form of a bull or a mighty warrior or something like that. And so by the 19th century, this word was cropping up in this mystical sense in English, in translations of things like the Bhagavad Gita or the Upanishads. And then you had a science fiction author, and science fiction has so often a pioneer when it comes to finding words for new things, called Paul Anderson, who wrote a book called The Avatar, which was sort of mystical, which had a very strong mystical vein, but also was technological. But for our purposes, the really kind of key moment came with, I think it was Neal Stephenson, who was writing in the start of the 80s in a genre that would come to be called cyberpunk. And in Snow Crash, he talked about avatars as, for the first time really, the bodies in which people incarnated themselves into a virtual world, into what he called the metaverse. And, you know, this is a really interesting idea, because the idea that we actually incarnate ourselves into these little sort of people or shapes, this captures something quite important about, you know, the nature of digital world, that this is incarnation, not just representation. And of course, as we know now, the word got taken up to describe the more and more complicated ways in which programs, in which software allows people to represent themselves.
These contextual factors, I think, are so important anyway, because ultimately what language is it's a way of symbolically representing belonging.
Yeah, and so on this, I instantly want to talk about video games, because it's such a tribal place. And, you know, I love the fact that you've got a lot of medieval vocabulary in video games, a lot of vocabulary that goes right back into the ideas of guilds, for example, which is really an old Anglo-Saxon word to do with the idea of tithing and paying membership to be part of a sort of an elite group of merchants or tradesmen who had the rights over something. And that's come through London and medieval guilds straight into this idea of strictly hierarchical in-game organizations with guild leaders and officers and even a charter who organize how to play and who enforce standards and leadership. And throughout gaming, you see all these words of vocabulary that are specialized to particular mechanics in games, but that are also designed to include and to exclude. We talk about players being noobs, N-O-O-B-S, or sometimes N-0-0-B-S. It's US military slang originally, but in games, along with the idea of the elite, it's come sort of via hacking culture to talk about different levels of initiation. And there's just an extraordinary wealth of words around gaming. And knowing these words or not knowing these words, understanding acronyms or not understanding them, all these, you know, play their part in this very precise negotiation of roles and hierarchies and status, as well as the business of just describing precisely what's going on in games, which are, you know, a very young, a very new medium, and one that's still evolving, a specialized recovery for players and designers alike.
But even with even within the inherent logic of programming languages, there's a cultural bias, I imagine, regardless of whether the people who are building those things, who are building the technologies, are aware of it or not. They are using a language which they are embedded in just by the nature of the fact that they live in a country or this is the language that they speak. There is an inherent logic that is shaping how we interact with the technology, is there not?
There is, yes. And you cannot escape the weight of this history. It so happens that Tim Berners-Lee was English and working in CERN when he conceived, in partnership with others, the World Wide Web. And so, you know, hypertext markup language has words in it, which are words of English vocabulary, which are defining ideas about, you know, text on screens and links, which go back partly to Gutenberg. The idea of marking up is an old printer's term dating back, you know, to 1485 and before. The ideas of punctuation, which are still, you know, sort of found in documents on the web and language in general, these all have their individual histories stretching back often through, you know, centuries of specific civilizations, as you say, in specific times and specific places.
So is there a degree of a, and this is going to sound quite extreme, but is there a degree of an English language imperialism associated with the fact that so much of the technology that we use today was built within a particular context from a particular linguistic, both offline and computer linguistic logic that came from a particular part of the world?
There's certainly a kind of totalizing tendency in languages online. So the writer Robert McCrum a while ago wrote a book called Globish, and he suggested that a particular sort of kind of global English is becoming very, very powerful internationally. It's not English as spoken in London or English indeed as spoken in Los Angeles. It's more a sort of base of principles which then sucks in local material from other languages. People also tend to talk about sometimes Chinglish, this sort of fusion of English and Chinese online. And it's certainly true that there is a logic to, you know, the way a lot of sites, a lot of languages, a lot of encodings work. And that logic is more hospitable to certain, you know, trends in language than others. I always think it's interesting in traditional Chinese how hard it is to make new words, because you have to go with existing characters. So to say computer in Mandarin, Tiannao, is to effectively say electric brain, and the word for electric used to mean lightning, and then it came to mean electricity. And if you don't know all this, it's very hard for you to work that out. If you're a Chinese speaker who is not familiar, who hasn't memorized the new meanings of these characters, it's really quite hard for you to work out what's being said compared, for example, to a very promiscuous language like English, where you can spell stuff out phonetically, where you can do a lot of explaining. So it is, you know, really interesting the way that things are constructed online, but I would hesitate to say there's an English language bias. I almost feel that, you know, the logic of technological systems is remolding that language itself, is remolding English, that much of language is what's malleable, and there are some deeper logics going on to do with information exchange and display. And these are the things that are changing our language.
Tom, thank you so much. Very interesting book. It's called Netymology. It's out now, is it, Tom?
It is. Yep, it's just out, yes.
It's just out. Congratulations. Very interesting, especially if you want to understand what it is that you're participating in online. It's always useful to be educated about what came before and the logics that are inherent in the narratives. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, Alex.
And Netymology by Tom Chatfield is available now on all on and offline bookshops. Now it's time for a tech news roundup with Jason Phipps.
Britain is attempting to opt out of the European initiative, enabling anyone to delete their personal details from online service providers, a power known as the right to be forgotten. The clash between Brussels and the Ministry of Justice has erupted in the final stages of negotiations over the EU's General Data Protection Regulation, which aims to rebalance the relationship between the individual and the internet. The debate reflects growing tensions between the freedom of expression and privacy, as increasing numbers of people complain that their online reputation is being corroded by outdated, inaccurate, or malicious information that cannot be removed. This week, a Guardian special project has unearthed hundreds of cases of people alarmed at the mishandling of their data or personal information. The UK's chief objection to the EU move is that unrealistic expectations will be created by the right's expansive title, because the controls proposed will be relatively modest in their impact on the way data spreads or is traded across websites. The right to be forgotten, Article 17 of the Data Protection Regulation, has been developed by the EU Justice Commissioner's Office primarily in response to complaints about the way social media such as Facebook retain and handle information. To read all the articles on the Guardian's Right to be Forgotten project, just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. The legality of selling digital music in the same way as old books or CDs has been called into question, after a New York court ruled that the act is in violation of the Copyright Act. A New York Federal District Court judge, Richard Sullivan, ruled that the digital music reselling company ReDigi had infringed on Capitol Records' rights to reproduction. Capitol Records filed a complaint against ReDigi in January 2012, instigating a challenge to protections of the first sale doctrine, which give owners of copies of products the ability to lawfully sell or lend a product, thereby allowing used bookstores, libraries, and video rental stores to exist. ReDigi, which launched in October 2011, allows people to sell digital music files at a lower price than that for which they were purchased. The court determined that ReDigi is not protected by the first sale because, to resell music on ReDigi, the file must be transferred to the company's servers in Arizona, which requires a technical, unauthorized recreation of the file. Judge Sullivan said in his summary that his decision would not exclude all digital works for resale, and that people could still sell a product that contains a musical recording, be it a computer hard disk, iPod, or other memory device onto which the file was originally downloaded. While he admitted that his judgment presented obstacles to resale, he said it was up to the US Congress, not his court, to determine whether this was an outmoded way of thinking. And this week it was reported that the external hard drive market for consumers has gone into reverse in the past 2 years, particularly in Europe, according to new figures from the consultancy FutureSource. New data supplied to The Guardian shows that total capacity purchased dropped year on year for the first time. And it's not clear that there will be a recovery in the hard drive market as people buy more and more tablets which connect to cloud storage. The principal cause in the drop seems, however, to be rising prices, initially triggered by calamitous floods in October 2011 in Thailand, where a number of hard drive component manufacturers are based. That caused dramatic shortages, and allied to growing consumer adoption of cloud-based storage services such as Dropbox, meant a precipitous drop in hard drive sales in the fourth quarter of 2011, which continued through to 2012. And this week we celebrated the 40th anniversary of the first mobile phone call on the 3rd of April 1973. The call was made by Marty Cooper, a senior engineer at Motorola, who called a rival at another telecoms company and announced that he was speaking from a, quote, real cellular telephone. To celebrate this, The Guardian has put together a gallery of images that illustrate the mobile phone's development from brick handsets to today's smartphones. To see the gallery and to read all the stories, just go to the best technology news site on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology. Coming soon, Jemima Kish meets Michael Brunton-Spall to review the new Chromebook Pixel. But first, if your eyes are too tired to read great Guardian writers such as Charlie Brooker or Tracy McVeigh, why not download for free The Guardian Audio Edition.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, scientists unravel the genetic causes of prostate, breast and ovarian cancer by Ian Sample. The Voice, Will.i.am looks like an action figure of himself and Tom Jones is Zeus by Charlie Brooker. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
I'm with Michael Brunton-Spall. He is the developer advocate at The Guardian who works very hard promoting the work that our amazing developer team do. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jemima. It's always nice to be here.
Now, you've been playing with something very exciting, haven't you, that we were lent on trial from Google. It's the Google Chromebook Pixel, which is their new top spec laptop. You've been quite impressed. Tell us why.
Yeah, I think firstly, it was just a really lovely piece of kit. I came into the office and I'd been reading all about the people who got their hands on one and you obviously contacted me and said, do you want to play with one? And I was like, oh, hell yeah. So I got my hands on it. It's got a wonderful keyboard. It's really nice, smooth action. The screen is just as good as everybody says. And it's a really nice looking bit of hardware. Like it doesn't have the Mac lines, the curved edges and the brushed aluminum in quite the same way. It has its own look that's is really nice. It's quite industrial, but I really, really quite liked it just as a piece of hardware, just picking it up and playing with it. It's nice and light and really good piece of kit.
How did it differ to your expectations, though? Because it's very different to the low-end Chromebooks that were released.
So I had one of the Samsung Chromebooks when they first came out. I got one of those 2 years ago. And that was, again, it was a nice piece of kit. The hardware was a bit plasticky, a bit tacky, but I think for me the main thing 2 years ago was picking up was that Chrome OS was essentially you were buying a laptop and then taking away all of the functionality that I would expect from a laptop. So I opened it up and I could browse the web, and that was all I could do. And the problem is my day job does not involve just browsing the web. I do programming, I run a team, I have to work with lots of different programs and applications and all kinds of quite complex things, and it was just too restrictive for me. It didn't even suit just my personal needs for playing games and things like that because I did too much with it. But what I did was with the original one from 2 years ago, the old Samsung ones, I gave it to my sister-in-law and she loves it. It suits her down to the ground because she's non-technical. She doesn't do a huge amount. Basically, she wants to watch YouTube. She wants to be able to blog from WordPress and she wants to be able to write some Google Docs and send emails. And that device is perfect for her. So getting the Chromebook Pixel, I was like, this is a really nice, fancy, expensive device that's going to be completely hampered by the operating system that's on it.
Well, it looks, on the outside, there are some very nice touches. Like there's no label next to the USB port saying this is a USB port, which you actually don't need because everyone knows that's a USB port. The mics and the speakers are all hidden. It's very pared down. It is very nicely engineered. But on the inside, you managed to make it and you entered a whole other world of usability by putting it in developer mode.
Yeah, so one of the things that Google tried to do with the Chromium OS or the operating system they put onto the Chromebooks is to meet two quite different needs. So the first is the kind of laptop that I'm going to give my mother to prevent her from calling me up endlessly about driver updates and strange things that have happened.
And I can relate to that.
Most of us who are in the techie world understand this idea because we're always being pestered by the non-technical people in our lives who want their machines fixed for them. And so they made it as secure as possible. It has to be protected from attackers. It has to be extended to naive users and inexperienced users. And that's the
term. This is Google's phrase, isn't it?
Google's phrase is to inexperienced or naive users. They should be safe from essentially breaking their own computers in some way and also safe from external people on websites doing things to the computer. The other thing that Google are very keen on is that the devices must be open. So they have to be able, you have to be able to install your own builds and deal with it the way that you would as a developer. And the problem with a device is if you make it easy to be open and do things with, you make it vulnerable to other people doing that to your machine, you make it easy to break something with it. So what the what the Chromebook Pixel has is a developer mode, which is quite tricky to get into. You have to go through quite a number of steps and jab all kinds of different keys and get it to boot. And it boots up with a big scary screen that tells you you're starting in developer mode. But at that point, you start getting a lot more control over the actual underlying operating system. And so what I was able to do was there's a project on GitHub called Crouton, which allows you to install a version of Ubuntu Linux alongside the existing Chromebook operating system install. And that means that you can bring up a terminal shell that us developers would normally use, enter your Crouton mode, and you have an Ubuntu terminal there that I can use. I can install Vim, and I can install my Java development kit and Scala compilation tools and actually start doing real development. And it's quite nice. It's just a terminal, so for those who are really, really techie like me, it's absolutely brilliant. And I could do all the things that I normally would. So I was able to actually get the Guardian's content API source code, check it out onto the machine, and build it. And while my laptop is aging a little bit, it's only 2 years old, and it was three times as fast at high CPU tasks as my current MacBook Pro, and it was faster than it for all the disk intensive tasks as well because of the SSD on the machine. So as a developer's machine, it worked quite nicely. And then if you need to do more stuff that isn't just in the terminal, Crouton gives you the ability to actually bring up an Ubuntu desktop itself. So you can actually bring up the graphical user interface, and then you can run programs that you might need. Like if you need a graphical editor like the GIMP, or if you need an audio editor like Audacity, you can actually install and run those in Ubuntu with all of the UI that you'd expect. You're not just restricted to things that are within a web page. And to me, that was the point at which the Chromebook Pixel went from being a fun toy that I got to play with for my work to becoming a device that I actually wanted to own and would be willing to part with money for.
And if people are trying to look for Crouton online, what's the spelling of that?
So if you're looking for it, it's on GitHub on dnschneid/crouton.
Okay, fantastic. Just makes it a bit easier for people to search. So clearly for developers, basically a super fast, really capable piece of kit. And as you say, for you, it was competitive with MacBook Air, which is quite a testimony, I think. For the layman, the most obvious beautiful piece of the Pixel is the screen, yeah. Which is Retina quality, although Google wouldn't use that phrase, obviously. And it's touchscreen, which is something a bit strange for a laptop. It does take some getting used to. But is this a bit too high spec, do you think, for a more general consumer market? I mean, Google's really made a machine for their own developers, haven't they?
Yeah, I think what Google are trying to do is they're building like a reference build device. They've done this recently with the Nexus 4. They're aiming to show all of the other hardware manufacturers, if you want to build a device, you don't have to be limited to building a $250 device that you can make with the cheapest possible components. It is possible to take what they've done and put it onto a really high-spec device. And so with the Nexus 4, they were doing the same thing with the phone. They were showing you can actually build this phone in this style, and I don't think they were really expecting quite as much desire from normal users around the Nexus 4 and the Nexus 7 as they actually got. What they were hoping for was what the other phone manufacturers and tablet manufacturers would step up and say, hey, you think you can do that? We can do better. And I think this is what they're aiming with the Chromebook Pixel. A lot of the talk I've heard from behind the scenes is that Google don't really expect to sell that many of them because they think that the that developers are going to, first of all, find the Chrome OS a bit restrictive, and developer mode is still not that well known. A lot of the developers I speak with on Twitter don't know that it exists, and they're, you know, laughing at the Chromebook Pixel. But the main thing that they're trying to do there is show this is what you could do with it. And the other thing is it's pushing the boundaries of what Chrome OS can do. So if you get a bunch of developers who have these devices and they're finding them restrictive, they're the kinds of people who are going to solve that problem in some way, shape or another. And Google are hoping that the developers will do that for them. They'll make the Chromebooks better and more usable for your average user because they'll be scratching their own itch. They'll be fixing these magical devices they want to own.
I think average users will, because we're so used to using desktops where you can download and access pretty much anything, that using Chrome OS is quite strange for the first time. It's more like a mobile experience because it's a more restrained, controlled environment. But perhaps people have an appetite for that now. So marks out of five, then, what would you give it?
I think for my mother-in-law, I would probably give it a 2 or 3 out of 5. I think it's a little too expensive. It's still a really nice device, but a lot of the power and the usability of the device is going to waste. So I would probably still go with one of the lower end ones at the moment. But for a developer, I'm really happy with it. I would give it a 4 out of 5. I think my biggest issue with it is just in one of the specs, which is the size of the SSD hard drive on the machine is very small. So the MacBook Air that it's the direct competitor to has a hard drive that's 4 times the size. And I think it's just that little bit too small for the price point. But as you say, the screen is absolutely lovely. And I think the touch screen could prove an interesting challenge to how we interact with devices in the future. Traditionally, web developers such as ourselves at The Guardian consider the idea of responsive design. So you may have noticed The Guardian website, the mobile site, is now using all these responsive design features. If you look at it on your desktop, it's wider and it uses nicer pictures. That essentially delivers you a more mobile cut-down experience. One of the things that a lot of responsive design developers are doing is looking at whether something supports a touchscreen and then assuming it's a small screen. And the Pixel proves that not to be true. It's actually got a ginormous screen, a lot of real estate that you can play with, but it gives you a touch interface as well. And a lot of websites didn't react well with that in many ways. So YouTube was a really good example where it couldn't seem to quite decide if I was a mobile device or a desktop device. You had to really push the site to say, I want to view it in this mode, at which point you couldn't then swipe through the videos and things, even though that's a lovely gesture that you want to do. And I think that challenge will be extended to web developers to say, how are we going to do that?
Just on the small storage side, you do get 1 terabyte of free storage, I think, on Google Drive with this. So yeah, there's some incentive there.
Yeah, the terabyte of free storage is actually, if you boil it down to the amount of storage you would get if you were buying it through Google Drive, it ends up meaning that the Chromebook Pixel is about minus $200 according to one calculation. That would cost you over $1,000 for that kind of storage. The problem with that kind of storage is you need to be online all the time to use it, and you have this constant thing of, I've got 1 terabyte of data, but I've got a 3G modem and I can only download it at a certain speed. What do I keep up there? What do I keep on the local machine? It would be really nice to have, and it's a really good extension of where you keep your files and back up your movies and pictures and so forth too, so you don't have such a working set. As a developer, I have a lot of stuff on my local machine so that I can use it, and I think that's the biggest issue for me with the device.
So that's the skinny on the Chromebook Pixel, which is either 2 or 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5, depending who you are, whether you're granny or dev. Michael, thank you very much. You can read more about our developer team on guardian.co.uk/developers. And you can order a Chromebook now for delivery in April at google.com/Chromebook. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Remember, for breaking technology news and much more, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. And on the site, you'll find an extra video treat.
What if you didn't have to search at all? Slip on your Google glasses and technology like GPS navigation.
Yes, why not watch our condensed and animated history of search, narrated by yours truly. But from me, Jemima Kish, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, see you next Thursday. Bye.
For For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.